If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think, I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Hi there. Some 6 weeks ago, Australian voters opted to reject the Voice to Parliament referendum proposal that would have created a mechanism for both recognising and listening to the country's first inhabitants. We know the margin, it wasn't even close. Referendums require a double majority to pass. At least 4 of the 6 states have to vote yes, and there needs also to be a majority voting yes across the nation as a whole. The Albanese Labor government went into the referendum full of confidence that Australia would embrace the proposal, yet they did not. Indeed, 6 out of 10 rejected it across the nation, and not one state returned a yes vote. So what happened to the early support and why? Fortunately, we are now much closer to knowing the answer, thanks to the regular ANU poll and the work led by ANU's Centre for Social Research and Methods and the School of Politics and International Relations, from which my co-host Maria Taflaga comes. Hi there, Maria.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I am very well. I, of course, am Mark Kenny, and with me to lay all of this out is a couple of excellent guests who can explain and probe the data that's come out just today, really. So you're hearing it first on Democracy Sausage, certainly if you're listening to us at the moment this pod drops. Professor Nicholas Biddle is Associate Director of the ANU Centre for Social Research and Methods, the aforementioned, and the Head of Methods, Survey and Evaluation Programs in the Centre. And he is co-author with Professors Matt Gray, Ian McAllister and Matt Quartrup, all of whom have been on this podcast, of a paper that has a very self-explanatory title, really. It's called Explaining Voting in the 2023 Australian Referendum. And that's out today. Hi there, Nick.
Hi, Mark. Hi,
Welcome
Maria.
Back. It wasn't that long ago we were
no,
talking
it's,
to you.
No, it seems like just yesterday we were preparing for the votes.
That's right.
And now we can...
Yes, we were talking about the survey that was in the field
that's
at the
right,
time
that's true. Yes.
And the numbers number crunching that you would do. Yeah. Also with us is Professor Valerie Coombs. She is a Quandamooka woman and is the Director of the Centre for Aboriginal Economic Policy Research. Welcome, Val.
Oh, thank you.
So, Nick, let's start with you. Tell us about this paper. It tells us some pretty fascinating things, like the fact that nigh on 2/3 of no voters said they had done so primarily because it was divisive, something about which I wrote and a number of other people did. It was a kind of a frustrating thing about the campaign. Mm. You know, they sort of divided the nation and then complained about it being divisive. Yeah. But it seemed to be an absolutely critical factor for no voters.
Yeah,
I suppose maybe you can start, even before you get to that, with just reminding our listeners what this survey is.
So I'll start with a bit of background.
Yeah.
So we've been running data collection on people's intended vote on The Voice throughout 2023. So we ran a survey in January, we did it again in April and again in August. And then leading up to the vote, we prepared as best we could a survey so it could go into the field essentially the day after the referendum vote was, the
completed,
information was completed. Yeah. So on, or 2 days afterwards, so on the Monday, our respondents were invited to participate in a pretty lengthy survey, trying to get both their views on a range of issues as well as why they voted the way they did. we ended up with a little over 4,000 respondents across adult respondents. Some of those weren't eligible to vote. We still asked them a few questions, but for the most part, we had people who, in every state and territory, every age group, range of education, background, so a pretty diverse
geographical spread.
Geographic spread, capital city, non-capital city.
A good sample.
Yeah, so a good sample.
And it's a healthy sample too. Like that's a pretty good number.
Yeah, so it allows us to look at pretty small population groups and really understand why they voted, their views on both political issues, but also views on broad issues related to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. And I think that's, as we'll get to, one of the key explanations for the vote. But as you said, one of our questions, in addition to saying, did you vote yes, no, or not at all, we asked people to give their views on why they voted the way they did. And so those who voted no said the main reason is because they were worried about division. And as you said, that became kind of self-fulfilling. If someone says, this is going to be divisive, people say, well, I don't want division. It's a little self-fulfilling. But also it's interesting that still a pretty high proportion of people who voted no said that they did so because they listened to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And that's and despite the fact that the vast majority of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, particularly those who've been involved in the Uluru Statement and more broadly in kind of issues to do with reconciliation and broadly on policy, the vast majority of Aboriginal people said they're in support of the voice and still a large proportion of no voters said that they did so because of kind of listening to the Indigenous population. So you kind of get some interesting dynamics and
that just shows in some ways that there's a lot of misinformation was a factor, right? I mean, it doesn't necessarily show it directly, but you can attribute some of those claims and those understandings to prevalent ideas that were circulating in the public space, but which were not borne out, as you say, by either the representation from the Uluru Statement from the Heart and all of those consultative mechanisms that informed it, nor by the voting data in some of those seats like Lingiari, where majority polling places of Aboriginal people, there was a 60-70%, 75% for yes.
And in our data, while we don't have a very large Indigenous population in our sample, still it shows what every other kind of survey has shown, which is that the Indigenous population was strongly in support on average for the yes campaign. So it doesn't mean that it's not true that they didn't listen, that they don't genuinely feel that they listened to the Indigenous population, but clearly there was a segment of the Indigenous population which they were listening to, and that kind of fed through into their perceptions.
Well, ultimately, just sort of like we discussed last time, there is like a degree of noise in these measures because you didn't have a free text box where people could say, my definition of division is X, it's what I heard from Peter Dutton, or it's what I heard from the No campaign. And again, it's potentially easy to infer that people might say they've listened to Indigenous people and really they mean the spokesman of the No campaign, which were led by Senator Price and Warren Mundine. And I suppose that's actually one of the challenges of interpreting this data, is that even though we have the placeholder division and we don't really know what voters actually mean by division, but what we certainly do know is what elites said, and we certainly know what campaigners said division was. And so it's not an unreasonable inference to make, but exactly why people might have worried about that, whether or not it was a deeply held position, whether or not it was pretty superficial and shallow because their party was now voting no, so they were voting no and the main reason was division. They're things we can't really fully know.
Yeah, no, it's really hard to kind of separate when people have kind of multiple explanations for why they voted the way they did. People will in some way self-justify, both yes and no campaigners.
And they'll adopt the official rationale, for example. The official rationale was that it was divisive. Yeah. Like if you looked at the No campaign, that became sort of the prime argument for not doing it.
Yep.
Dutton was hammering that from quite early on, well before the official campaign period started. So it was almost, sort of baked in before things.
And people will pick up the cues from the groups who they associate with, and that might be the political party which they associate with, and therefore they'll follow those cues, or it might be another group, a social group, and will then use that both to help make their decision, but also to explain why they made the decision they did.
Yeah, so you could, for example, Val, take the view that you don't want to do it because you think Aboriginal people have already had it too easy. They've already got more than, and some of the data in this shows that there are attitudes like that, that Aboriginal people have been given sufficient leg up already, and that their disadvantage may be a factor of their own fault or whatever, but people aren't going to say that. They'll come up with a more respectable rationale in some cases.
So that they aren't accused of being racist. People will say all sorts of things. And there's been this rhetoric and these explanations ever since I've remember people saying, and when you said about divisive, that's a way of saying, well, I don't want to say that I'm racist and I'll vote no, but I'll say I'll just vote no because it's divisive.
Yeah, because I'm for equality. We are
divided. Mm. We've been here 65 to 80,000 years and other people haven't, so that's a divide for a start. And people use other types of English words to soften the blow because people say, I'm not racist, but da-da-da-da-da. You shouldn't have programs, or we're all the same, we're all Australians. Well, actually, I wasn't an Australian citizen when I was born. My mother wasn't a citizen, so... And when you point things out, well, we're all the same. Well, we're not. We've been here for a lot longer. Oh, well, you know, that was such a long time ago. So there's all this rhetoric, I think. Some of it's about people were assimilationist. They thought we should all be the same. That's lovely.
And there was a bit of that actually sort of creeping into, you know, the messaging. I mean, we saw Senator Nampajipa Price at one stage say that colonisation had not been bad for Aboriginal people.
And she is a politician, and governments and politics is about, you know, getting re-elected and averting criticism.
Yeah.
So I'm sure she would romp it in the next election because of her attitude, and of course she will. Mm. You know, people could argue that colonisation was a great thing. It's a kind of a strange argument to have, really, when you think about it, but that takes you back to what people need to hear, what Australians need to understand, what Australians need to hear, but they don't hear. They don't listen. We have a word where I come from, where your ear is your binung, and when you're deaf, it's binungari, which means your ears don't work. But there's also a word called binungunj, where they can hear but they're not listening. Mm. So there's a lot of that in Australia because there's things they don't want to hear, like our life expectancy is shorter, all sorts of statistics show, which is why the government's committed to the close the gap.
Yeah.
So why would government have to commit to close the gap? Why do Aboriginal children still suffer with rheumatic heart disease when it's virtually eradicated from the non-Indigenous population? And even in the 70s when I worked in remote areas, we had people, Aboriginal people, still with Hansen's disease, and white people hadn't contracted leprosy or trachoma for many years. So if you talk to an Australian about that, or try to have the – and there were some debates and arguments on various places, including Facebook. People using these arguments, oh, your life expectancy is shorter because you're all drunk and you don't eat the right food or things like that. You know, well, it's not that simple, you know. So to bring the two groups together, the First Nations people and the newly arrived, it doesn't matter when they arrived, I think we have to look at a different way of approaching Australia's problems in terms of how they see us, how they recognise us. And it has to be done a lot better and a lot smarter. I think it could have been handled a lot better. Not, no disrespect to the people that went out campaigning, of course, but also we've got a constitution that relies on the people in the country having to vote for us to get recognised. And that's a really – that's a horrible situation to be in. We're reliant on the majority – of people to vote for us. 97% of the population aren't us.
Mm.
And when people say, oh, I heard an Aboriginal, I remember my in-law of mine said, oh, there was an Aboriginal woman on TV and she said when she got taken away off her family, it was the best thing that ever happened. Mm. And he was a strong union member. And I said, well, I've had people on there saying we don't need unions. Does that mean we don't need unions? And he sort of said, oh, but I had to point that out to
him.
But I think they get great comfort in hearing that government's doing things that Aborigines might think are okay. I don't know what it is, but the facts seem to surprise and startle people and they're not comfortable.
Yeah, and you get this disproportionate weighting then that's put onto that one anecdote that seems to confirm my view of the world, right? So that example you quoted there, or lots of the news stories that we saw, broadcast stories in particular, through the campaign, you would hear Aboriginal people in remote communities or in regional communities interviewed saying, oh, I don't think we need the voice, you know. And it did give this impression, if you were just doing the, you know, because they were doing this kind of 50%, 50-50, yes, no reporting all the time. Yeah. It gave the impression that that was also reflected in the Indigenous population. And if it was, then why would we, white Australia, be supporting it if they're not even fully behind it themselves?
There's all these amazing arguments that you hear, but when you hear someone refer to us as the Aborigines, then you know you're in trouble. But, you know, there's even my father's non-Indigenous and his family, they grappled with my father marrying my mother and they still grapple till today. And I have first cousins who are non-Indigenous people, and my cousin said to me, well, you know, you're really lucky that it wasn't the French or the Spanish that colonised. I'm thinking, well, you know. So,
okay.
Or I took my dad to see his sister and she said, oh, I hear you got letters after your name, which is means I graduated from university. But I didn't sort of say I'd graduated a few times, but I said, yeah, I have. And I sort of remembered why my mother stayed home. My mother just couldn't cope. I took Dad because he couldn't drive.
Yeah.
And she said, you know why you're smart, don't you? And I said, no. She said, because you're half white.
Oh, wow.
And I thought, okay. And I said, you know, I could say that I'm smart because I'm half black. And she went, oh, like I was cheeky or out of line, and my dad just started to laugh because he knew that would be the response. But it was him that taught me to fight like that, not my mother. My mother was scared that we would be taken and things like that. So he was the one that challenged. So it's an interesting, it's been all of my life that you have these little lame excuses as to why people decided to vote. Now they would say, well, no, I'm racist, I don't like Aborigines, or the woman, when I moved into a house, she said, I'm not racist, I just hate filth and all Aborigines are filthy. So I thought, okay, that's nice. And then she realised, she came over to my house and said, we're selling our house, but I thought I'd bring the potential buyers through. They can see that your house is really clean and that you're good neighbours. And she still to this day doesn't understand why I sort of told her. So I think Australia in general is really seriously misinformed. And I can honestly say, as an Aboriginal person, if you move into a house, I really don't think, other than in Canberra, that someone would say, oh, there's a person living next door who belongs to the planet's oldest living culture. Isn't that wonderful? It would only happen in Canberra. It would not happen anywhere else, or it would be less likely to happen anywhere else.
Yes. And this jurisdiction did vote, the one we're sitting in, did vote pretty much a mirror image of the nation, which is kind of interesting. And I suppose that drives us to a question about, you know, sort of the obvious one is geography, but perhaps the more important one is education.
The Canberra electorates, there's a little bit of variation within Canberra, but if you look at the kind of electorate level, it wasn't just Canberra which had kind of overwhelming majority, but those electorates or areas which did have vote overwhelmingly, yes, tended to be those with a high proportion of people who completed year 12, yes, or had a degree or a postgraduate degree. So one of the big differences both in our survey data, so looking at individuals, or when we look at the area level data, it is education which is driving the difference. And it's not because people with higher levels of education are wealthier or not. You leave that aside and there's still differences. It's not because people with higher education are younger. Leave that aside, there's still differences. There's something different in the views of those specifically related to education, which kind of drives quite different views on a range of social attitudes and political questions, but The Voice far more than I've seen in any other kind of election campaign.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, you know, that reflects the discussion we had last time around how education is related to certain socialization mm-hmm. processes and the types of exposure that you kind of get through critical inquiry in general and on this subject in particular, yeah. Right? And I mean, I think it's actually really interesting because I was about to ask you, Nick, about the generational yeah. differences. And I suppose it's interesting that the education variable holds even yeah. despite that. But was the generational differences like statistically important, which kind of reflect a lot of the things Val has just articulated?
Yeah, no, it's certainly true that, and we don't have this, we can't get this from the electorate data because there's most electorates have a similar kind of average age, so you don't get the same variations you do with individual level data. And certainly those in our younger age groups, so 18 to 34 roughly, were multiple times more likely to vote yes than older Australians. And
they're also far more likely to have a degree.
Exactly. But both of those kind of were operating independently. Mm-hmm. And I think it's partly to do, I think, with the, you know, Val, you kind of talked about kind of misinformation. And certainly when I compare kind of my schooling experience to the schooling experience of the people who we teach at university compared to the schooling experience of my kids who are kind of in early high school, differences across those cohorts and then compared to my parents or my grandparents, it would have been more different still. So I think, yeah, both of those things are kind of feeding into the amount of information people have, the ability to kind of maybe see through some of those arguments, which might not have a lot of validity to them. But I think shouldn't just think it's about kind of information or just think it's about kind of socialization. Because I think one of the other differences between someone with a degree or not is that they're pretty comfortable in their financial position, not just at a particular point in time, but kind of looking ahead into the future. So someone with the same income but a higher level of education is far less likely to be worried about how their financial situation might change into the future. So
because
I think
their employment's more secure.
More secure. It might be lower on average, but it's kind right. of it's more secure. It's more stable. So I do think while The Voice, it's really hard to see how that would have any immediate impact on someone's financial position. But it's easy to make a case that for those who are financially insecure, that, well, we shouldn't be focusing on this. We should be focusing on something else, the cost of living. Or alternatively, that the Indigenous population is going to take something away from you. And we do see that in the data. That
Yeah, well let's come back to that in a moment. We'll take a quick break and we'll come back to that very interesting point.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
it helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. Now, just before the break, we were talking about this idea of the attitude that many Australians might have towards Aboriginal people and this question of fairness and so forth. And in fact, I'm quoting from your report here, many Australians feel that special rights, this is from your paper, many Australians feel that special rights for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australians are unfair, with a sizable number of Australians also thinking that the reason for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander disadvantage is a lack of effort.
Yeah, so as mentioned at the start, we asked a range of kind of attitudinal questions and views on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander policy and peoples. And it's hard, it's confronting to kind of ask and analyse questions which are quite derogatory towards towards our First Nations people, but having doing so allows us to really kind of draw out that explanation for the vote, which is that there is a sizable minority of people who feel that the Indigenous population receives services or whatever, which other people aren't entitled to.
Well, they were encouraged to feel that.
Exactly.
By the
case. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this idea of special rights, I just found it completely bizarre all the way through. What special rights? Actually, there weren't any special rights. It was a body, it was a power set up in the Constitution to be legislated by the Parliament. Now, I know there will be people listening to this who are saying, get over it, the Australian people rejected it. And it's true, you can criticise the model, right? Clearly, the Yes campaign was unable to persuade enough people that the voice model worked. It wasn't clear enough and so forth. But the idea that it conferred special rights on anyone, there was no obligation for anything other than under the Constitution for the Parliament to legislate into creation a voice, the details of which were entirely up to the Parliament. And this was just lost.
Yeah, and I think that was a part of the reason why not all no voters, and certainly when we look at the data, the vast majority of people still say that in their view, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander population suffers disadvantage because of past government policy, and the vast majority of people think that there's only a minority of people who think that kind of land rights or government support has gone too far, but it's enough. It's enough that if you have kind of people who are on the margins, people who may be a little bit concerned, a little bit risk averse, that there's enough people who feel that the Indigenous population has things which they don't deserve, and therefore they're not going to vote for something else. And I think that's without kind of countering that view and without kind of changing that view, then I think it's going to be really hard for any policy like this to get a majority support.
Yeah, Maria, that's one of the problems, isn't it, in these things? It's almost like apart from the incredibly high hurdle that a referendum has to get over, there's also the sort of problem that the Yes case has to get enough people to agree to a particular argument. The No case can get people to agree for a whole bunch of different reasons, a whole clutch of different arguments. So some people will vote no because of the special rights thing. Some people will vote no because they've heard that there's going to be a land grab. Some people will vote no because they think it won't work, or that's what they said,
That's right. I mean, to vote yes, you need to agree with every step of the proposition.
Yeah.
And you only need one point of exit to vote no. And I think the data that, the answers, some of these answers are kind of contradictory, right, to these surveys. Like overwhelmingly people say they're proud of Indigenous cultures, or that racist policies have impacted Indigenous people. But, a lot of, like nearly half or just over half think that, Aboriginal people need to try harder, right? And so that really reveals the disconnect that we were talking about in the first half of the show. I mean, like how can you sort of... It only really makes sense to say this group of people faces disadvantage, but they need to try harder if you don't actually do any thinking between that proposition and the idea that they need to try harder. Because, why is it the case that these things persist, right? Like it's not just because people haven't tried harder. It's because there are systematic barriers. And I suppose this might go to the socialization effects of universities, in which one tends to encounter sets of arguments that seek to explain how these kinds of phenomena arise, which might make it a lot easier for you to sort of see the purpose of a voice mechanism of any kind or a specific one that is, you know, reasonably technical, actually, given most people think we have a Bill of Rights, even though we don't. You know, like, people's basic knowledge of our institutions and civics is really low, and that was a real failure on the part of the government to not really prepare the country to at least move the population to a slightly more even playing field.
Yeah, so I think there are contradictions in people's views and their opinions, and I think it's partly because, you know, as you said before, you kind of have reasonably crude questions: yes, no, agree, disagree. So it's hard to really pick up the nuance of people's views. But I think when you kind of look at all the data items together, kind of what distills in a traditional no voter is that, yes, government has failed in the past. Yes, government's had racist policies, but now everything's fine. And now everything's fine, so we don't need to do anything else. And I think that's valid. It kind of picks up some of the points you're making about things which people have said to you or said to their families. It's a, oh, yeah, things happened, but...
Yeah, and it's not new.
Yeah.
It's been happening. It happened when Australia had to try and cut a rug with the UN. It had to do a whole lot of things because there were 600 million people decolonized in the first 15 years after World War II. So that changed the shape of the world dynamic. Australia really wanted to be part of the UN, and it really wanted UN conventions ratified. But the newly decolonized people made up the UN, and they knew exactly what was happening in Australia. So Australia was forced, even though it probably didn't want to, it was forced to address that. And it had to change its constitution and had to remove, before the conventions would be ratified by the UN, the UN said that Australia had to do a few things. And one was to remove all racist legislation from its statutes. It had to introduce Racial Discrimination Act, and it had to bring in some form of Aboriginal land rights. So you see the Commonwealth's efforts to fight with the states over that so they could get the conventions ratified, and that made some radical change. And the same arguments that are floating around now, why people voted no, were put forward then. And then because the removal of racist legislation, particularly in Queensland, for example, where I come from, resulted in some interesting outcomes. And one was the Station Hands Award or the Pastoral Workers Award, which is set up specifically to provide cheap labour for pastoralists. Once the pastoralists had to pay award wages, they just kicked everybody off what was usually the pastoral lease, which was, of course, their own traditional land. These people had nowhere to go. So there was a mass influx from pastoral properties into Queensland towns and cities for the first time in colonial history. And might we say, people didn't cope with that. And also the government reserves in Queensland, people were freed up. In 1965, Queensland government lost the ability to take any Aboriginal person and place them on a reserve indefinitely for sometimes four or five generations. And in 1971, they changed the legislation twice in 6 years, which was unheard of in Queensland. Aboriginal people were free to leave after 1971. So again, there was a mass influx of Aboriginal people into Queensland towns and cities. And people were aghast. People didn't want to see that suffering. People didn't want to share their towns and cities with Aboriginal people, and even though they knew we were here first. But one thing that I found living in one of those country towns, my mother was a fantastic dressmaker, and we had great clothes, my sister and I. Well, that was offensive because we were uppity. We were uppity half-castes, and I remember the policeman in Hughenden described me as a half-caste, quarter-caste slash scrubber, probably because I could run fast, I don't know. But I sat for the post office exam after high school and got a job on the telephone exchange, you know, the old-fashioned switchboard. There were complaints written in that they were given Aborigines jobs over non-Aboriginal women, particularly in those days. But I'd passed the exam and they didn't, you know. So it was pretty obvious. But that didn't stop people. And then when you look at the movement into towns like Cloncurry and places like that, even the local mayor, and, of course, they had to provide housing because these people were homeless after leaving the pastoral properties. So government built houses and the Commonwealth forced the state to build houses outside of reserves for the first time in Queensland's colonial history. So houses were built. They said, these Aborigines got better houses than white people.
They got something which we don't have.
Or they're living so close we can smell them from here. You know, it was just unbelievable, the comments. All, so all Australia's this, grappled this, with all of this forever. It's and, not
and,
new.
And none of this sort of granular detail, these personal accounts are really powerful, but they didn't really get discussed in the campaign. I mean, there was a real sense from even from the Yes camp quite early on of staying positive, of not telling the kind of, you know, the checkered history, the dark history of colonisation, the massacres, the herding of people onto reservations, the taking of children, the
well,
you
even
know,
you know, terra nullius.
Yeah, terra nullius. I mean, terra nullius, you know, sort of, that kind of barely got a mention to the extent that did. It was sort of felt like it was that was that had been resolved by Mabo and Wick and so forth. But I felt like in a way the Yes camp was fighting with one hand behind its back because of that, because a lot of the logic of the voice was about addressing the sort of things you've just spoken about, was about addressing an intergenerational tale of disadvantage. And
or government's inability, because Gough Whitlam wanted to represent, because the Commonwealth had entered Indigenous affairs after the 67 referendum, but it didn't know who to listen to. And he set up the first elected representative body, but they had so much to look at. They had to look at international issues, national issues, local issues. So they had to change the structure of that. Nugget Coombs did a review. Then they had in they had the NACC, then they had the NAC, then they had ATSIC. But anything government can legislate, they can take away, which is why they wanted to change the constitution to embed it so they couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But these same arguments will go on forever. It's how we put a stop to that.
Well, can I ask you this, going back to the data? I mean, it shows that something like 40% of people who voted no said they would have voted yes had it just been about recognition. Sorry, my voice dropped down there.
So recognition as well.
As in, had it been to recognise the first peoples of Australia but not putting the voice
symbolic
itself.
Symbolic recognition.
Yeah, symbolic, yeah. Now,
what, to say we were here first?
Yeah.
In other words, why would you spend money on a referendum for that?
No, I'm not arguing the point.
No, no, I know
I'm
not
arguing for that point. I'm just saying it's interesting that the voice, so if we're to believe the data, and I think
the data is
robust, notwithstanding that some people will come up with rationales and the like, but so you've got 40% of people who voted no saying that had it not contained the creation of the voice mechanism, they would have voted yes. And that's supported to some extent by the other data about the levels of pride in Indigenous culture and some of the things.
So what do you think it was about the voice that they...
That the voice was able to be depicted as a special right, as I was saying before, that it was able to be depicted as a body that gave them access to Aboriginal people, access to decision-making and leverage in the process that ordinary folk didn't have. That it was going to be a gravy train for inner urban Aboriginal elites. I mean, there are a whole range of tropes that were sort of argued here.
It's a bit like, ab study and free cars and concepts like that.
Or your example about housing just then. I mean,
Even native title. We got native title on North Stradbroke Island in 2011 and they had a meeting of concerned citizens. And in the native title process you have respondent parties. People can become a respondent parties. The beekeepers became respondent parties. Recreational fishermen become respondent parties. So they get notified all the way along of what's happening in the federal court when you have your directions hearing, isn't things.
Yeah, in relation to
what's happening with the claim.
Yeah.
Yeah, the native title determination application. So we got native title close to Brisbane in 2011. And the state government rang us and said, we're going to have a meeting of concerned citizens. And I said, my cousin and I'll come. They said, you don't need to come, Val. I said, yeah, no, we'll come. You really don't need to come, Val. I said, yeah, we'll come. I just wanted to hear what they were saying. And they were concerned about exclusive possession because that's the highest level of native title. Does that mean we can't take our dogs on the beach? Because they'd had all this rhetoric from when the Native Title Act, when the Mabo decision was handed down.
Yeah.
And I couldn't understand that. And I don't want people who use Thunderboxes living next door. There were these really crazy ideas. And I think if I ruled the world, we'd go back and talk to those people again and say, well, what changed in your life since Quandamooka got native title in 2011? And most of them will say, well, nothing except now we're safer from bushfires because local people do the township fire management or something. But the misinformation and the racism was astounding. It was really quite hilarious when you go back and think about the excuses they used about why they were concerned about native title. So I think Australia grapples with everything to do with First Nations people, not just the voice. They grapple with everything that happens along the way.
I think that's reflected in the campaign because so many of the like ideas you just articulated were wrapped up into this concept of the voice. I mean, if we actually held a national pop quiz and people actually had to submit in writing what they thought the voice was, I'd love for that to be done because I actually wonder how many responses would match the actual question, right, and the actual mechanism that is under deliberation.
Well, Reconciliation Australia's barometers that they run sort of show.
They try and ask that, yeah. And then I think they will be kind of doing follow-up questions. So I think the few examples you gave with native title and also some of the rhetoric around the voice is about kind of losing something. The difference with just straight symbolic recognition is you don't lose anything. Like there's nothing like, oh, sure, you can have recognition as long as I still get to have whatever I have. But the argument that the voice will lead to someone losing something is far harder to counter than the argument that, you know, symbolic recognition doesn't matter. So we kind of see that in the data, which is that people who thought that there was going to be a cost to them were far more likely to vote no. And I think that was one of the challenges of the Yes campaign is to say that it will have an effect.
This is what we see in all politics, really. Yeah, I mean, exactly. we saw in the 2019 election with the asset attempts
death
to
tax.
Asset taxes generally you were able to convince a whole bunch of people they were about to lose something. You know, I remember Albanese was approached at one stage when he was in opposition at the time, and this woman explained to him why she couldn't vote for Labor anymore because of the franking credits. And when he quizzed her about it, went through several questions and established that she was a pensioner and had no
She had no shares.
She wasn't going to be paying any franking. But to her, that had been the motivation for deciding to switch her vote, even though she'd been a lifelong Labor voter. And so that was someone who was, in a sense, frightened across the divide into the other camp. And there was probably a fair bit of that that went on. Can I ask, I'm not sure who wants to answer this, but I guess what this raises, though, about this question between symbolic recognition and material recognition, which was really the argument for the voice, was there any merit in asking that as two simultaneous questions? In other words, not just one question on the ballot, but two. Would the question of symbolic recognition, I mean, the data suggests symbolic recognition would have got up and the voice would not have got up. Would that have been an advance, Val, had that occurred?
Look, I don't think so. I think I go back a little bit because I'm a historian, I can't help myself. But I wonder if we hadn't had our convict origins where government does everything rather than a free settlement, and we were one of the few colonies that were established where the missionaries didn't come first. We were convicts. They had convicts. Mm. So everyone expects that government's going to do everything, and we still always believe that government's got to fix this, government's got to do this, government should be doing this, government shouldn't be doing that. There seems to be a strong reliance on what government's doing and what they shouldn't be doing, because you see everywhere, well, we shouldn't be giving overseas aid, we should be looking after people in the countries. It's not really an either or.
Mm.
So I wonder whether that has set in stone our relationship between First Nations people and Australians because of those origins. Mm. Because there's been arguments all the way along about what to do with us and to deal with us.
I suppose what I was getting at, though, really was
a different question.
What I was probing really was the possibility of whether an incremental advance, albeit that some people criticise it as entirely symbolic, but an incremental advance as distinct from a complete repudiation, which is what we saw in this vote. So it gets up in the Constitution as recognising the 65,000-plus year occupancy of this land.
But what would that do?
Well, it's a legitimate question to ask, I agree, and that was why Aboriginal people didn't put that forward.
But I thought the voice was about Aboriginal people having influence over policies that affect their lives.
It was, but the
Australian
people...
So how would that recognition give you influence over what government does in terms of policy to affect their lives?
Yeah, well, that's a completely legitimate question. I'm not arguing the
point. Well, that would have been a waste of money, I would think, because what would that the reason for the voice was that so Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people can have real influence over the policies that affect their day-to-day lives.
Yeah.
It wasn't about asking white people whether they're going to recognise us, let alone like us. So I think that would have probably not served any purpose.
Yeah,
fair enough. I think but there's also even more than not serving a purpose. There's a risk. I think this is probably why the part of the decision is that, well, we've ticked that off.
Yeah.
We've done that.
Yes,
and therefore,
and so it's got no momentum in it anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think there would have been a risk of having kind of recognition only, and then if you do then come back to say, well, let's legislate a voice, or let's have a follow-up referendum where with a voice which is going to have more than something symbolic, then there's a risk of people saying, well, haven't we already done that?
Yeah, you've given away the kind of leverage on the question.
I mean, if we actually think about the rhetoric of the leading No campaign, right? Like originally it started out as the problem is putting it in the Constitution, but having a voice mechanism is a good idea. We should legislate it, right?
Yes.
That was the argument primarily of the coalition before the middle of the year. But that kind of morphed pretty quickly, actually, into we don't need any of this and recognition, symbolic recognition, you know, if that was just the question, we'd do it today. And I think therein kind of lies the answer.
Mm.
You can kind of justify why you've voted no, following cues of your, you know, political elites by saying, well, we could just do recognition and that would have been the smart or the wise thing to do. But, you know, I think one of the things that most irritates me about this example is particularly, I suppose, from people who might strongly identify with the coalition and who might claim to have followed the debate very closely, is that it's actually that government that put in all of this infrastructure to build this proposal, right? Like they're the ones, it's literally their proposal. And so, you know, and Dutton, I think, really exemplified this when he sort of said, well, where's the detail? You know, none of this work has been done. I haven't seen it. Like he's literally in the cabinet.
Yes.
That was responsible for developing
those Uluru dialogues.
Those models, yeah. And it's true to say that the Albanese government didn't exactly follow the precise roadmap that was developed by the then previous coalition. And, you know, it's fair enough to say that Dutton might not have agreed with it. But the idea that he really was in ignorance, that's interesting. He either really didn't know and wasn't listening and paying attention, or he didn't care.
Yeah, and his key argument, which is where we really started with this, about it being divisive, I mean, you know, you just had to compare the 67 referendum and this one and say, well, what's the key difference? The key difference is bipartisanship. You could have easily argued that the 67 referendum was divisive if you wanted to, but by simply having the parties divide on it and campaign vociferously against it and exaggerate what it might do to the fabric of society or whatever it might have been, but that wasn't the decision at the time. A Conservative government, a Labor opposition that were as one on it, the question went through.
So why does the Conservative government always have to be like, because look at what the Conservative government did in relation to the native title. I mean, even the Attorney General at the time put out information that was totally wrong. You won't be allowed on the beach and things like that. And Johnny Howard brought in the 1998 Act amendments that weakened everybody's rights.
But yeah, there was a lot of fulminating, wasn't there?
I don't understand racism, but I think that's what we're dealing with here. And I think we really know now that Australia's a pretty racist country. We can dissect it and do whatever we like. But historically and currently, we are a racist nation. And how do we fix that? Reconciliation? The people that follow reconciliation are the tried and tested anyway. But if you talk about Canberra and other areas where it's a little bit less, is what's the solution? But the solution has to come from non-Aboriginal people. They have to fix this. Not us. They have to fix it. Yeah. And I don't know how. What do I tell my grandkids?
No, it's a very very good point. I don't have the answer to that.
Well, we have to do the work.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, non-Aboriginal people have to fix their own problems here in this country. And I don't know what leaders you need, but I saw Paul Keating punching above his weight with the Native Title Act and on Talkback Radio and saying, look, I'm hanging up, you're just a redneck, you know, sort of thing. And he had good words to say, but he didn't get re-elected and he wouldn't have gotten re-elected because of he was brave enough to do various things, you know, various inquiries, a Royal Commission and various things that happened. So when somebody does address racism or has a go, they certainly aren't popular.
Well, look, we're going to have to run out of time, so we're going to have to wrap it up there. But I suppose one of those messages that comes out of that, just to answer your rhetorical question, feel free to buy in quickly if you want to as well, but perhaps it needs a Conservative government to lead that argument, you know, like as in a moderate Conservative leader who can then draw the Labor Party along and the Greens and so forth, because this process, this referendum, we can look back on it and see that it was doomed at the moment that it didn't have that bipartisan support.
Well, I guess I think about some of the campaigning that people like Julia and Lisa did from the Conservative side of politics.
It
would have been plenty of people dissatisfied with those sets of arguments. But, you know, it is possible that it could have drawn in more buy-in. I mean, I think what is interesting is Nick's data shows that people who speak another language other than English at home actually have much higher rates of support for the voice throughout the panel data than English-speaking people.
And you, to be fair, you predicted that. I remember you saying that on this podcast a number of times, just from your own experience, in the migrant community.
Yeah, and I imagine it would be conditioned by age again and education, but I thought that was interesting, and I think the data sort of shows there are sort of seeds of hope here, but it's not a quick fix, is it?
No, because politics lets down those seeds of hope, partisan politics and the temptations of populism and so forth, and we've seen that. We're going to have to wrap up now, unfortunately, but look, thanks for what's been a really, really interesting and rich discussion, and thank you, Nick, for breaking this news on Democracy Sausage, which, of course, people will be able to find more detailed, have more detailed access to in a variety of ways once they've stopped listening to this. So that's it for us today. Thank you very much to Nick Biddle and to Valerie Coombs. To you, Maria.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
That's it for Democracy Sausage for this week. Talk to you again next week.